for the space craft on the surface of Moon or Mars or whatever. And I had a number of questions. So first, maybe, there was the response from Paul and from Dr. Roy. Maybe Paul, please, could you please say a few words?
Okay, hopefully everyone now hears me. So I don't know, Wes, you know, like I said before, this doesn't solve any problem at all. This is just a storage medium and a very expensive and unproven one. So the bottom line remains, where are you getting the energy to begin with? Now, if you want to haul a bunch of radioactive material up to the moon and build your own reactor, lots of luck. But other than that, some solar cells are not going to produce the mega joules of energy that you're going to need to fuel anything. So you still got the same problem. You need to get a lot of energy to the moon and to Mars, and there's no practical way of doing that in a costly manner.
So, let me make sure that I have it. Okay. So, I had a few questions too. So, I saw a problem that iron powder is fully recyclable in that process. On the earth, but to recycle it, there is a need for energy to be used for deoxidation, so you could reuse it. So the purpose of solar or wind energy for it is one of the solutions from economical perspective on the earth, and entire industry making iron powder is needed. And the plan for solar power, so wind turbines, doesn't come without the cost, maintenance, and land. And then iron ore is not an iron powder. So I repeat it again. Iron ore is not an iron powder. Of course, I'm not a chemist, so please correct me if I'm wrong. So without the industry for it, you cannot have it, that iron powder. So in space, that University of Eindhoven never provided calculation for the amount of oxidizer to be used in the moon and means of providing it. But Paul had an idea for oxidizers there for it. Paul, pick up if you can.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, there's different ways of getting oxygen off the moon. But again, it's going to take a lot of energy. You have to get into the craters and dig out the ice that's there, which is, you know, it's composed of water from all of the eons of time. So it's accumulated in the shadows of the craters. So you go down there with, I guess, a core borer. By the way, that kind of ice, it's not going to core bore like ice on the on the North Pole or South Pole. It's going to be like steel to try to get through that, and to try to get these core sections out of the crater. Wait till they try to do that. So now you got that, and you melt it down, and then with the electrolysis. By the way, you're going to need a couple of nukes to keep that going. You know, you're going to know, like where there's a lot of joules of power to separate the hydrogen and the oxygen. The good thing, though, out of it, you're gonna get the oxygen. You could breathe. You could use it for this perpetual motion machine thing that you're talking about with the iron powder. And the good thing about the oxygen, you know, of course, you could breathe it. You could also use it for an oxidizer for rockets. And the hydrogen and the oxygen could both be used four fuel cells on the moon, so you could have these little cabins set up all over the place, and they could be running on fuel cells. God help you, if one of them fails, you better have a good backup system, because you're going to freeze to death on on the South Pole. They got a long way to go, but it's fun to talk about. Back to you.
Dr. Ray, what is your comment?
Pretty much the same that I always make. You're going to have to actually find a legitimate way of supplying incredibly high-density energy that takes up as little mass as humanly possible and is hopefully not awfully dangerous. And unfortunately, the only thing with that capacity is going to be fusion. Lots of luck with fusion. I understand that fusion is only 20 years away. It has been for 100 years. So it's ultimately, push comes to shove, if people want to do anything legitimately long-term, they're going to have to bring something with uranium or plutonium or what have you on the ships and put together a little fission reaction generator. That's the only way they're going to get power. I mean, they can then use the power to do all kinds of interesting things. And the other problem is the cost of getting machinery to any planet. It's easier to kind of land on a moon or Mars and somehow magically build machines. But you can't do that using a teaspoon or something. You need industrial machines to make other machines. It's kind of a bootstrapping situation. So you're going to have a lot of problems with the manufacturer of any heavy-duty device. You're going to have to figure out how to kind of change the laws of propulsion and get the dollar per kilogram to be a lot cheaper in order to use propulsion to get factories on the surface of a planet or on the moon. Otherwise, you're not going to be doing much mining with a teacup.
Reusable, self-compact, and easy transportable is not. So that is something that some German university was trying to promote, but it's not, at this stage, it's not available, so to be delicate in words. I'm kind of surprised that German university went with or came with such a solution. Let me go to the next one. I think Dr. Roy would like it very much. Let me drop it. This is N2XJ again. So we have a subject. All the particles to make up the matter around us, such as electrons and protons, have antimatter versions which are nearly identical. But in with the mirrored properties, such as the opposite electric charge, when the antimatter or an antimatter and the matter particles meet, they annihilate each other, destroy each other in the flash of energy, and then we have few photons left over. That was used in, how was it called, a medical device, Dr. Roy, PET device. Okay, anyhow, let me drop. Okay, so there are a few questions. We had a big bang that was before the human animal was shows up on the surface of the earth. There was no earth, there was something that was to be earth. And before that, there was a Big Bang. So the Big Bang should have created equal amounts of matter and antimatter, but process in the early universe gave the preference to matter. And the question is, why? And Dr. Roy, you have the same questions in your email. The second question was, as the universe cooled, all the antimatter was destroyed, leaving a tiny surplus of matter. And the question is, so why? Why antimatter was destroyed? Another question was, in recent research shows that the neutrinos and antineutrinos oscillate at different rates, favoring matter over antimatter. And the question is, why? Dr. Roy.
Okay, just to begin this discussion, and my apologies to anyone who gets a nosebleed or gets bored, because this is rather esoteric here. The principal short-term answer is physicists don't really know. There's no particular proof one way or the other why this happened to the universe, but thankfully it did, because if it didn't, then basically there would be no matter or antimatter in the universe. It would all be photons bouncing back, forth, and sideways, and that wouldn't be fun for you or I, because life as a bunch of photons would be an unrewarding one. So that's the simple answer, that we don't know. Now, you got to kind of define things, because if you don't define things, I think far less people have the faintest idea what any of us are talking about. What you're saying, incorrectly, I think, unfortunately, is that scientists have discovered that neutrinos, by the way, are interesting particles. They were discovered on a theoretical basis back in the 30s. It took 20 years to prove them. Matter of fact, Nikola Tesla thought, I think he had caught something like a neutrino at some point. He thought it was superluminal. He thought it traveled faster than the speed of light. So he thought it was his proof against Einstein, and he, of course, was going to call them Tesla particles. But that's a supposition. There's nothing to prove anything one way or the other. So neutrinos are very interesting things. They are chargeless, so they don't interact with the electromagnetic field, the electric force, electromagnetic force. The standard theory would suggest that neutrinos are massless, but they're not. They have infinitesimal mass. They have approximately 1/2 millionth the mass of an electron. So electrons are rather light, too. So they're very light, they're chargeless, and they go through everything. A lot of radioactive decay produces them as byproducts. The sun pours out a lot of them. Trillions of neutrinos pass through your body every second from the sun, and other stellar objects produce a lot of neutrinos as well. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, there are three types, there are three flavors of neutrinos. There are electron neutrinos, there are muon neutrinos, and there are tau neutrinos. And when Wesley says that they oscillate, what he means is that we discovered that as a neutrino travels through space, it actually changes flavors. It changes from an electron neutrino to a muon neutrino to a tau neutrino back to an electron neutrino. And that's what gave us the knowledge that neutrinos have mass, because if they had no mass, they wouldn't be able to change from one to the other. So that's an interesting aspect. And there are antineutrinos. Now, what Wes alluded to is that an antineutrino oscillates between the three types of antineutrinos, the anti-electron, the anti-muon, the anti-tau, at a different interval of time that the actual neutrinos do, which would violate something called charge parity, symmetry, which is the thing that might explain why you're left with a little bit more matter than antimatter, because if the symmetry was perfect, you would not have any residual matter. You would have just photons. So it's that understanding that fuels research to prove this asymmetry in charge parity. Now, so far experiments suggest that there's some degree of charge parity asymmetry, but it doesn't prove it yet. There are things called sigmas. I think the experiments that take it to about a sigma of 3. You need a sigma of 5 for it to be a sure thing. So it is not a proven thing that charge parity asymmetry in neutrinos is one of the reasons why we're here and matter is here as opposed to just photons.
actually we have most of the answers for the questions. Although it asks for more questions than due to your answers, but we're going to be spending whole night talking about it, and the audience may get bored with it. So, if you have anything more to say about it, I would be happy to hear it. And if not, I go to the next one.
Okay, I happen to have heard a very foolish-sounding theory of why the universe is full of matter. By the way, apparently the physicist's kind of conceptual idea of this is that each time, during the very earliest first moments of the universe, when it was really, really high energy, hot, condensed, and very, very compacted, photons would decay into particle pairs, and particle pairs would combine and turn into photons and such, that all you need is an asymmetry of one case in a billion in order to ultimately, when the universe cooled down enough, would leave us with about 1% of the mass energy in mass and 99% of the rest of the energy as photons, which we now call the cosmic background. Also, we don't have any idea really what the weight of neutrinos are, except that, as I mentioned, they're lighter than one half a millionth of electrons. They have a good idea of how much that's not really the weight of one neutrino, that's the weight of one electron neutrino plus one weight of a tau plus one weight of a muon. They know the combined weight of three different neutrinos being approximately one half a millionth of an electron's weight. But they have no idea which one is lighter, which one is heavier, or any idea. They just know the composite mass approximately. So there's a lot of really, to me, interesting things about neutrinos. I understand that some people find this kind of, you know, pie in the sky type of stuff, but it's cutting edge physics. Matter of fact, over the other side of Long Island, that big lab is working on heavy anti atoms. There was a write up that's available, I believe, on my link page of work that they've had building the most heavy anti atoms in history. So they're doing their part as well on the other end of Long Island.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I don't know if Wesley read the URL that I sent back to him. It had to do with the neutrinos, the detector that they're building in South Dakota. It's called the Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment, which I'm amazed at. On that place, they dug down 1 mile into the surface, and they built these three or four different gigantic caverns. Each one is going to be like 500 feet long and about seven stories, you know, about 70 feet deep. And I think there's three or four of these things, and they're going to fill it up with liquid argon. When they're done, well, they're going to put a insulated steel frame all around this thing, and then they're going to put detectors inside and fill it up with liquid argon, and they're going to wait for a neutrino to hit. And it should be active, I think they said 2027 or so. But that was a fascinating story. Anyway, Roy, back to you.
Thanks, GS. Yeah, neutrino detectors are fascinating things. There's more than a few of them out there, and they're basically these big vats with a lot of detectors. And as I mentioned, trillions of neutrinos are going right through you as we talk. So, you know, billions of trillions of neutrinos go into that, and very few actually interact. The problem with neutrinos is that they don't interact with a lot of the fundamental forces of nature. They don't interact with the strong nuclear force. They don't interact with the electromagnetic force. They interact with the weak nuclear force, and to a small degree with gravity. And we don't even quite know why they have weight, you know, what their mass is from. So it's very difficult to detect neutrinos, and you know that was one of the ways that we figured out that they oscillate, because we had detectors designed for electron neutrinos, which come out of the core of our sun when it fuses, and we had a lot less neutrinos than we thought. So we had to figure out why they weren't showing up, and the reason why they weren't showing up is because they were oscillating into other undetectable types of neutrinos. So neutrino detectors, again, fascinating subject. I look forward to understanding them a little bit better as the years go on.
KF2CC.
Yes.
While we're on the subject of subatomic particle physics, I was curious, is there any particle that can move faster than a photon?
No. It's not a function of the particle, except, you know, if you want to bring up imaginary particles, which are tachyons, which don't exist, whose mass is imaginary, whatever that means. So the mathematics works if you use an imaginary mass. Tachyons never travel at the speed of light or below. The nature of imaginary mass particles, which don't really exist, is that they travel at infinity, and if you put a lot of energy into them, you can slow them down so that they travel a little bit faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. But again, those are imaginary. The speed of light is not the speed of light in a vacuum is not fundamentally a function of the particle. It's a fundamental aspect of space-time itself. Causality itself cannot travel through space-time at a velocity of any faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. So objects that are not dragged down by rest mass can travel at the speed of light because space-time itself limits everything to that maximum.
If you take a photon and you shoot it, let's say, I don't know if this could be done, is there any way to accelerate a proton using gravity assist?
No, because you are using Newtonian physics in which you can add up velocities. If you're standing in a train that's traveling, say, 10 miles an hour, and you put down a little toy train that's traveling 1 mile an hour, then the total velocity of the toy train is 11 miles per hour. That's Newtonian. That's not relativistic. Relativistic works in weird and mysterious ways. If you have a photon of light going forward and a photon of light going backwards, and you were somehow able to kind of sit on that photon going backwards and looking at the photon going forwards, it would still be traveling at the speed of light in a vacuum, not twice that velocity.
I've always wondered why the universe is so vast. It's almost like things are being separated on purpose.
Well, it's very big, and it's been increasing in size. The scale has been going up over the last 13 billion plus years. So that's why it's very, 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 very large. And we're very, 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 very small. And we're not even evolved to really conceive of the volumes. We don't even know how big, quote, the universe is. We have an idea of how big the observable universe is, which is the universe where the light particles traveling from the farthest reaches have just had enough time to reach us. But there are things that exist beyond that point that we will never see. As time goes on and the universe expands, the light cone that we exist in will narrow down, and we will see a smaller and smaller percentage of the total universe, and that our observable universe will be very limited by the speed of light in a vacuum.
A very interesting point. Now let's extend this a little bit further. What created the Big Bang, and if there was a Big Bang, who created the creator that created the Big Bang?
Okay, Big Bang, not well named. It was actually named by a guy who didn't believe in it, so it was actually an insult. It's not a Big Bang. It's an inflation. What happened is there was a unstable field in space-time that got disrupted and got destabilized and inflated. So an almost infinite amount of energy and an almost non-existent point expanded. So the universe is not banging. The universe is just scaling up, and it's getting larger and larger and larger. There's no way to tell what came before it. Time itself, for in our reference frame, began at the beginning of the Big Bang. So we may coexist in a multiverse with parallel universes and universes that bud out of ours without our having the faintest understanding or knowledge about it. It's all supposition. Now, if you're going to kind of take the infinite regression game of, you know, what caused this? Well, then what caused that? Well, then what caused the other thing? You will inevitably always give yourself a headache. There are some rather sophisticated theories in which time kind of folds in on itself and you don't need a beginning. But if you want to take the old standard approach of who did that, so who did this, so who did that, that's usually theologians kind of try to do that so that you bring it to God. But then the trick is to say, well, who created God? And then they're kind of doing the same thing that I said the other guys are of time kind of looping over itself, because they say, well, God just always existed, which is not a terribly good answer as far as I'm inclined to believe. So infinite regression just tends to give everyone headaches.
When I look at the universe, I see two things, most basic level, creation and destruction.
Well, there's no actual proof of destruction. I mean, things end, or things blow up, but then they turn into other things. It's kind of good that the things explode. The material that makes up your body, with the exception of hydrogen, all came out of explosive stars and all kinds of things. If not for destruction, if you would call that destruction, I wouldn't. There would, instead of, as I mentioned earlier, with the problems matter and antimatter, instead of photons just kind of banging around, there would just be some hydrogen and helium gas, which wouldn't be fun at all, because you can't make much of a human being out of just hydrogen and helium. So, you know, creation, I don't know. Again, that kind of brings you back to all kinds of, you know, how did that happen, and what happened before it, and what. But destruction can lead to further creation, in my humble opinion.
Is antimatter a fact, or has it not been proven yet?
No, it's an absolute positive fact. Matter of fact, I forget the laboratory at the other end of Long Island, but they're making anti-atoms out of antiparticles. Antiparticles certainly do exist. Matter of fact, if you eat a banana, there is some radioactive potassium in it, you will emit antiparticles. You will emit positrons from your digesting banana.
medically used.
Are you talking about Brookhaven Lab, WS2N?
Yes, yes. I always block on Brookhaven, but they issued a paper about a super, relatively the heaviest anti-atoms manufactured have been manufactured in their labs, and that's nice to hear that they're doing great stuff like that. Getting back to Wesley's comment, it kind of goes back to many years ago. We had a real weird discussion about positron emission tomography and how it worked, and a guy who thought he understood it because he occasionally went to lunch with guys who built them. But nevertheless, the positron emission tomography is a method of medical imaging. You inject the material that is radioactive, and that, tie it, I think, to glucose or something, so that high metabolic rate cells take it in more than others, and then they decay into positrons. The positrons combine with an electron nearby and produce a pair of gamma rays with half a billion electrovolts of energy. There are detectors on both sides, and is used to produce a 3D image of the decay products, which allow you to image organ systems that have high metabolic rates. Usually those are active cancers.
Cancer cells are notorious for PET scans because they have an affinity for picking up the glucose at an accelerated rate.
Yeah, because they have a high metabolic rate, because they have a faster turnover, because the reason that they're cancerous is because they've lost the inhibition to know their place in the hierarchy in the area. And if there are more than enough cells around, they don't reproduce usually. You know, if you cut yourself, the cells in your skin can tell that there's something bad going on, and they increase their metabolic rate, and they reproduce just enough to cover up the wound and heal yourself, and then they go back to their quiescent matter. Cancers have lost that ability for sundry reasons, and so they swallow up voluminous amounts of glucose energy so that they can build more and more cells to just kind of flood your body and destroy it from within.
I wonder if glucose could be used as a method for targeted cancer therapies.
You sort of have the same problem that you had with coronavirus, where someone said that, you know, if you pour bleach on the viruses, they die, so why don't we just swallow bleach? The problem is the rest of your body needs glucose as well. So if you poison your ability to have respiration, to have oxidized sugar into high energy components that fuel your life, you'll end up poisoning yourself. So you'll kill the cancer, but you'll kill yourself. The big problem is finding that fine line where you try and kill as much of the cancer as possible without killing yourself.
Oh, interesting. I agree with that.
Okay, there was some doubling that was going on. The other guy that isn't Brian, what did you want to say?
Oh, nothing. I'll just be listening.
Okay, over to you, Brian.
It's just quite fascinating how many galaxies there are in the universe that we know of, and how many star systems in those galaxies, and possibility of life, which I have no doubt about. Otherwise, I think everything would be an awful waste of space.
Well, that presupposes that there's some underlying reason for anything. You know, science often kind of suggests to us that a lot of stuff happens because it just happens. It happens that. So it's the way things are sort of set up for their own reasons that bring you know, these different causalities. There probably is a lot of life in the universe, but as you mentioned, it is really, 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 really big, and it is very, very, very hard to get anywhere in it. You know, I mean, we can barely travel outside the solar system if you got, you know, 40 years to kill. So, you know, traveling to the closest nearby solar system, lots of luck. Traveling to another galaxy, not unless you got a warp drive on you. So, yeah. I don't think it's really that you're going to meet anyone in your lifetime, or a hundred lifetimes, or a thousand lifetimes. But I'm sure among the trillions and trillions of galaxies with trillions and trillions of solar systems, there are planets that have organic life form. This very instant in time.
I think it's kind of amazing that we have not yet been able to receive, or at least maybe perhaps radio waves are not the way to go, but I would think that probably would be any sort of intelligent communication that we could figure out.
But you have the same problem that I mentioned earlier. Light can only travel through space-time at the speed of light in a vacuum. That means that, okay, your radio waves have gotten to Alpha Centauri and maybe a couple of other solar systems. But that, you know, we're near, anywhere near the middle of our galaxy. You're certainly nowhere near a nearby galaxy. Again, the speed of light is fast to us, but when you understand how many light years diameter the observable universe is, it's a pittance. So again, if you go on the radio and blast away, I don't know how many thousands of years it might take to land on a planet that has life, and just because it has life doesn't mean it receives electromagnetic waves. We didn't receive electromagnetic waves just two centuries ago. If you would have blasted us with radio waves 500 years ago, we wouldn't have noticed.
Did you ever see the movie Contact?
I've seen pieces of it. I don't think I've ever kind of sat down and watched the whole thing. It's based on the book by Carl Sagan, so I know of it.
Great movie, by the way. WS to us.
Okay. Hopefully all of this should make us think. I mean, if you ever get particularly arrogant with yourself, consider how minuscule your existence is in the frame of the universe. You know, 13.8 billion years, if you're lucky, you make maybe 90 years, and you'd run out of room writing all the 0.00000000, et cetera, all the way to 1% of the volume of the universe you take up. So, you know, we're quite insignificant, you know. I mean, we could even blow this planet up, and I don't think a couple of solar systems down, they'd even notice. So, again, it's all interesting to ponder.
There is a lot of, essentially, I think there's a tremendous amount of life in the universe. We're just too far apart.
I wanted to say something.
Certainly, Wes, you started this.
No, Paul wanted to say something. Paul? I think Roy heard me. I just said it was a great movie. Terrific. And unfortunately, Carl Sagan himself never got to see it because he passed away before the movie actually came out.
Okay, so I'm going to try to close it because I have only one subject left. As far as the subject of underground facility, I have a few notes. So that was the cavern led by in South Dakota, which housed the gigantic particle detectors deep underground in the Twin Air experiment, and it was the multi-institution research that was the University of Texas Austin, there was Fermilab, UT the physics facility with Carol Lang and plenty of others, and CERN was involved in it. So it is a colossal cavern. There are two of them, each one more than 500 feet long and about 7 stories tall. So 7 stories tall building 1 mile below the surface of the Earth. And then we have two facilities. They are at a distance of 800 miles from each other. The one is a transmitter of neutrino, so it's a proton accelerator that gives the neutrino production, and also there is a particle detector there. And then if we take the curvature of the Earth, we have a 32 kilometers, which is 20 miles, from the surface of the Earth to the straight line that is from the transmitter of neutrino to the detector or the receiver of the neutrino. And then we have that receiver of the neutrino, which is the lab that is underground, 1 mile underground, and it has the particle detector as well. And so 800 miles difference between 1,300 kilometers. I'm European, so I like it better. And we have the structure. So that word was Paul talking about it. The engineering and construction, let me drop. The engineering and construction and excavation teams have been working 4,850 feet below the surface of the Earth since 2021. Stanford Underground Research Facility and South Dakota portion of Dune were involved in it. Workers spent about 2 years blasting and removing about 800,000 metric tons. So it's not pounds, it's metric tons. The metric ton is 1,000 kilograms. Each kilogram has 2 pounds. So we're talking about twice of that in pounds, right from underground. But my question is, if we have a 7-story tall structure of the device, which is the detector of the neutrinos, how do they put that underground, Dr. Roy?
I think that's more of an engineering question than it is a science question. That where there's a will, there's a way. But all these kind of detectors are kind of intriguing and rather expensive. And the idea of that particular detector you were talking about was particularly built to detect muon neutrinos that were produced in accelerators, as opposed to electron neutrinos that just come out of the sun. You know, those things, they bake down on us during the day, and even in the middle of the night, they come up from the other side where the sun is and go right through the core of the Earth and right through us as well. So, this particular one is more designed for muon neutrino observation and I guess they wanted two detectors at two different distances so that they could document the oscillation of the muon neutrino changing into a tau or an electron neutrino, which has been documented repeatedly. Covering your audio is at least 20 decibels below what it should have been. Design I do not trust modeling software as much as you do or the person who wrote that article. It might work well for people who speed and regularly risk their lives, but most people who want to fly on an airplane or what have you would like a relatively safe and tested model. So I certainly, if I knew that they had not test flight these planes, but simply run them on simulators and they passed, I would run in the opposite direction from the plane, the designer, and the manufacturer.
Primarily the
the pathology of radio waves. If you touch a live antenna, the RF will give you superficial bursts. So it's more of just heat problems and burn problems. That's the pathology of radio waves for the human body.